welcome to the Nature Garden Podcast with me, Carl Steinson, and the Weekending Show team from Lionheart Radio. Come along with us as we take a bunny wee wander along nature paths, shorelines, riverbanks, through woods and wetlands, parks and gardens, and it's a chance to hear some great Northumbrian stories. On today's show, spring has sprung and we're celebrating the change of seasons. New shoots and the colours and scents of bulbs in the garden. Tom Pattinson's here to tell us more. Our resident adventurer, Tom Cadwallander's watching the early spring birds coming in, and we're joining him on his ever so exotic travels in Costa Rica. And we welcome two new guests to the Nature Garden, John Knox and Dean Smith from the Annick Poison Garden, in a series of botanical features you really won't want to miss. Plus some top tips for the garden from Tom P, all coming up on the Nature Garden Podcast. Time to enjoy and celebrate the coming of light, and to mow and sow and just get generally carried away with gardening and spring. And Tom Pattinson's doing just that, while keeping, well, a careful eye on the temperature, weather and the soil.
The first weekend in April and the second herald the beginning of a new garden season for many people, but you have to give a little thought before you go out there if you haven't been gardening regularly throughout the year, as many of us do. First and foremost, think about the weather conditions and what you're sowing or planting. There's still a real risk of frost, and there's still cold nights out there. What is important is the soil temperature. If it remains below 10 degrees Celsius, there's not much going to germinate or grow for that matter. It needs to improve slightly. You can help it along if you're going to start your gardening outdoors by sowing vegetables. You can help it by putting a cloche or some form of cover over it to warm it up a week or so beforehand. Then sow the seeds in there and they have a better chance. My first sowings outside or salad crops, the leaf lettuce types and the radishes, and sow them, put the cloche on and just leave it covering. I'm also planting early potatoes, first early potatoes. Some varieties which are listed such, they need 10 weeks of growing time. Problem is, If their shoots come to the surface too quickly, and there's still a chance of frost around throughout April and into May in this neck of the woods in Northumberland. So we have to be careful. Keep an eye for them, sending the shoots up 2 or 3 weeks after sowing, after planting the potato tubers, and cover them over, earth them up, earth either side to cover that young foliage to protect it from the frost. I ensure that that young foliage doesn't come up too quickly by planting each potato at a decent depth. I go down as far as 12 centimetres, sometimes 15 centimetres, that's 6 inches. They will reach the surface, takes them a little while, but it's just an extra assurance against frost. Once the potatoes have been sorted out, then we can move on to other hardy vegetables. I wouldn't be sowing the likes of sweet corn, corn on the cob, outdoors at the moment. But what I can sow outside are the garden peas and beans, because they've shown me in the past that they can stand the cooler weather when they reach the surface. Better still, if you'd started off some seedlings, in, say, the garden room of the conservatory, and harden them off in a cold conservatory on heated greenhouse, for example, then they'd stand a chance. Alternatively, you can buy some young plugs of vegetable plants at the local garden centre. They'll stand up well. When you're doing all of this work, another thing to bear in mind is aches and pains and possible back problems. You see, if you haven't been working, taking a lot of exercise for weeks, months on end, suddenly you go into the garden, you want to do everything at once. Not the best way to approach it. Set little targets for yourself. Say you've done, half an hour on the vegetable plot. Maybe start up to an hour, say, and then do something totally different. If the lawn needs trimming, and most lawns do it this time of year, mine particularly, I trim it every 2 months after putting the lawnmower into the garage where it stands for two months. I bring it out again just to keep it tidy throughout the winter, because the grass, even in December, January, with the slightest encouragement from the sun, will put a little bit of growth on. So mow your lawn. If you mow the lawn, immediately it lifts the ambiance of the rest of the garden. But don't go straight into the mowing. Check it to see if there's any debris that might affect the blades of your mowing machine first. And then lift the height of the cut, not at summer, way above summer level, 2 or 3 notches. Make it a high cut first, and then go down in stages in successive cuttings. It's making a start in your garden.
Northumberland's alive to birdsong at the moment as newcomers join our stalwart feathered friends in the gardens and fields from far and wide. And Tom Cadwallader from the British Trust for Ornithology's absolutely loving it.
Well, it's great to be back home, back on the Northumberland coast. I've had 3 wonderful weeks in Costa Rica, and you may hear a bit about that during the course of the programme. But it's been brilliant, but it's great to be home. And at this time of year, it's fantastic, because it's just the turn of the season. You know, we've got from the back end of the winter into early spring. And whilst I was away, I was hearing reports from home about the first of the summer migrants coming in. And sure enough, a lot of them are here. And as I got home, my first wandering round of the morning yesterday, chiff-chaffs were kind of abounding. And the chiff-chaff, chiff-chaff, chiff-chaff of the calls that we're making are just sort of a great buzz, because you know they really are the first of the migrants for the summer. And chiffchaffs are relatives of willow warblers, and they're quite closely related. They're quite hard to distinguish. However, their call is significantly different. And these are quite small birds, small greeny yellowy birds, about 5 inches long, perhaps not even that. But this is the frequent, the kind of the little wooded areas, the kind of the scrubby areas. So there are plenty of them around. But also there's the first of the sand martins are coming in. And I've heard reports of swallows. And just today I heard the first record of a house martin. So they're coming back. Still a couple of weeks yet for the swifts. But, you know, the swallows and the house martins are not far away. And the sand martins are here in small numbers. And indeed, offshore, we're seeing sort of just the small numbers, the vanguard of the summer breeding seabirds. The first of the sandwich terns are now seen offshore, which is fantastic. And if you go inland, you go into the hills, the first waves of ringousels, you know, those relatives of blackbirds, the ones with the white breast bands. The males are quite sort of quite special, and the black and white plumage is almost like tune supporters. But the females are brown and they're kind of less gaudy. But yes, they're coming in and they'll breed in. They're kind of like mountain blackbirds and they breed in the uplands. And indeed, all the resident birds are getting themselves sorted out. I've been hearing song thrushes. In fact, song thrushes were singing before we left, which was the beginning of March. Song thrushes were singing. Missile thrushes were singing, and they're still sort of out there and doing their business. They're trying to attract the mate, trying to get organised. But check out your gardens. If you've got nest boxes, just check out your nest boxes, because the blue tits are investigating. In fact, some of them may well be nest building. Some of them may well have their nests already built. So yeah, they're getting themselves organised, ready for the breeding season. And it's fantastic, really, to see the change. But it's a great thrill. And it's still early days yet, and we still have the dribs and drabs of our winter visitors. I shouldn't say dribs and drabs, really, because they're not really dribs and drabs. They're still wonderful. You know, the wintering wildfowl that have been here, the teal and the widgeon that have been here in very big numbers. And when they first arrived in the autumn, they arrive in their dark and dreary, sort of camouflagedy, cryptically plumage. But now when they leave, they've gone through their molt and they're looking their absolutely finest best, because they're heading north and they haven't got time to waste, and they've got to be right and ready for their, when they get onto the breeding grounds, they've got to have their best plumage to attract a mate and to start the whole process all over again. And so they were on the Isle Nestory here where I am. We've had up to 600 widgeon during the course of the winter, but getting back, in fact when I left there was still 300 or 400 here. But now I was out this morning and there's only 20 or 30 of them left so far. They're all kind of making their way north, and these birds will be breeding in places like Siberia. Can you imagine that? Breeding in Siberia, for goodness sake. But the reason they come here to the UK and the Northumberland coast is that, believe it or not, we have a relatively benign winter. But anyway, that's another story altogether. So these birds are heading north, and it's great. And we're also seeing birds on passage. It's just a super old time. And I was hearing reports from my pals at the BTO, the British Trust for Ornithology. They've got this great scheme about satellite tracking cuckoos. And they're telling me that one of the tracked cuckoos has just crossed the Sahara. So yes, here we are, very early April, and we've got the first of the cuckoos crossing Sahara. And these birds will be with us within 10 days. They'll scoot through Europe. Given the right weather conditions and looking at the weather forecast, we're going to get into a nice sort of southerly or southwesterly airflow through Easter and into the following weeks or so. So we should see a flood of migrants come pouring in. So we should, hopefully, by middle of April, we should have seen quite a large number of swallows and house martins and sand martins, and the first of the kind of the songbirds, the white throats and things. We'll be all out there. And of course the skylarks, give a bit of sunshine and the skylarks are singing, giving it all, which is wonderful. I love this time of year. I'll just really love it. It's wonderful. I get a real buzz, and hopefully you will too. Anyhow, I'll see you later, folks.
Now, whether it be a bowling green work of art or a much smaller green feature, grass and lawns are a thing we love. And this week, Tom Panson's got his eyes firmly fixed on the moss and turf.
Continuing with lawns. If you're thinking of making a lawn, this is the ideal time to start. But first you have to decide what type of lawn is it going to be. Is it going to be an ornamental type that I can look at and admire? It will take some footfall when I'm inspecting the border, walking over it, but most of the time it's there as an ornamental feature. If that is the case, then you need to put together in your mind, if not on paper, a plan for maintaining it throughout the year. If it's to be a lawn that is utility in nature, that means you have children in the household and they want a place to play, receive a heavy footfall, or you want somewhere to hang the washing out, then you don't need to be so fussy and buy the top quality grass seed or lay top quality turfs, because that's the way to do it at the moment. If you want an instant lawn at the moment, you simply go out and buy some turfs of the type that you want, utility or good quality. Normally, a reasonable turf in this area at the moment, Northumberland, costs about £5 for a square metre. And that's, I think that's reasonable. Work out the cost beforehand. And grass seed is cheaper, but again, it comes in grades, utility, or at the top end, truly ornamental lawn with first-class fescue grasses in. Once you've made your mind up, prepare the area, get out all the stones, make it firm, then rake it over and apply your grass seed and wait 2 or 3 weeks, depending on the weather, rake it in for it to germinate. With the turf, of course, the advantage is you can have a lawn instantly. Bare patch one day, complete lawn the next, if that's what you want. The lawn, my lawn, does have moss. And most lawns have an element of moss in after the long winter and moisture. If you have poor drainage in the lawn, that may be the root cause of your moss. It may also be that you mow the lawn too closely last year and moss has gained a foothold. Is it because the soil is acid and that encourages moss to develop? And the other problem is overhanging trees. If there's a lot of shade, it will develop there. Now, when I have moss on the driveway, I just get a pack of iron sulfate and wear gloves, of course, and I sprinkle it all over it one day and it's turning black the next. And then when 2 or 3 days later, it's dead completely, I just rake it off. Some people do the lawn that way, but please, before you start treating or raking out the moss in your lawn, do check or try to work out how it's recurring, if it is recurring. Once the lawn has been taken care of, then, and a few early vegetables planted, we can start thinking about other things, can't we? Other parts of the garden. I've noticed recently that one or two of my wires that support the raspberry canes, which are tied to wires each year, they're loose a bit. I must tighten those up. I always notice the weeds, and there are quite a lot of weeds. And the big thing about annual weeds is straightforward job. Get up there with the hoe when the sun is shining. If there's a bit of heat in the sun, hoe them, leave them, and they'll have completely dried out, desiccated by the end of the day. You can rake them off, and if they haven't seed attached to them, if they're not seeded, they'll go into the composting facility. If they have seeded, then I'd leave them out. That's one of the things I've been doing at the moment. All of this work is pretty hard, actually, or can be. This is why, at the top of these recordings, I suggested you... We have a word for it locally in Northumberland. It's take great care, go slowly. The word or the phrase is gan canu, and that's what you need to do at the moment. No bad backs or anything like that. So I do a little bit outdoors, physical stuff, and then into the greenhouse and do a bit of potting up and so on. And then, best of all, I go for a visit to a garden nearby, see what other people are up to. Garden visiting is just opening up the season for that now. So that makes a pleasant change.
And now we begin a very special series of reports from the legendary Annick Poison Garden in Northumberland. Stand by, folks, for an amazing tour of the dangerous world of plants and some sound advice. A very warm welcome to John Knox and Dean Smith.
Daffodils. Have you ever noticed how a daffodil bulb and an onion look remarkably similar to one another? If you was to eat a daffodil bulb thinking it's an onion, you would die 8 to 10 hours after consuming it. They contain alkaloids which will attack your stomach and provide you with a slow, painful death. Roman soldiers used to use them if they were captured in battle. They will be transported back to the enemy's camp later that night, where they were sure to face certain interrogation. They used them as a way out. 7 or 8 years ago, a major supermarket chain here in the UK inadvertently put daffodil bulbs and onions next to each other in the aisles. The health scare that it caused changed the law in the way that these daffodil bulbs must be displayed. Unfortunately, just a few weeks ago, another supermarket chain did exactly the same thing with spring onions, leeks, and daffodil bulbs. Daffodil bulbs do, however, have quite a good redeeming feature. They contain a chemical called galanthamine, and galanthamine is one of the ingredients in a treatment for dementia.
So there was an incident a few years ago where a group of friends had gathered for a dinner party in the UK. The host wanted to add a touch of spring to the table, so placed a nice bouquet of daffodils in a vase as the centrepiece. Unbeknownst to the host, daffodils release toxic compounds called ligurine and calcium oxalate crystals into the water. During the dinner, one of the guests accidentally drank water from the vase by mistake, thinking it was a glass of water. The guest soon experienced symptoms such as a burning sensation in their mouth, difficulty swallowing, and a sore throat. The other guests quickly realised the source of the problem and contacted emergency services. The affected guest was treated with antihistamines, pain relief medication, and eventually made a full recovery. So last year, Dean, we got contacted by BBC Radio.
It was,
To have a little discussion about daffodils.
Yeah, so apparently in the news, last year, around about April time it was, a council down in the southwest of the country, around the Cornwall area, had planted a number of daffodils, but then there'd been a sudden outcry that they're poisonous, and they removed them. And of course, this made all the headlines. So we were contacted by BBC Radio Coventry, who asked us for an interview. And of course, I explained all about the poisons within daffodils. Now, these daffodils are very attractive and everybody has them in the garden, but nobody quite realises how dangerous they could potentially be.
So there was a dog poisoned in a suburban neighbourhood. So this curious dog managed to dig up and consume several daffodil bulbs from its owner's garden. The dog soon became lethargic, started drooling excessively, and experiencing vomiting and diarrhoea. The concerned owner had rushed the pet to a vet, who quickly identified daffodil poison as the cause. The vet induced vomiting to clear the dog's stomach of any remaining plant material and administered intravenous fluids to prevent dehydration. The dog did recover, but it was kind of weak for a good couple of weeks.
Wow. This is the thing. People wouldn't necessarily be aware that the dog could be digging up things like that in the garden and potentially poison themselves. They let them out the back door and they've got no idea what could be in their garden.
Yeah, and it's a similar thing with a lot of spring bulbs. They've got quite a sweet smell to pets. So they'll be inquisitive and they'll dig them up. And if they haven't got a nasty taste, there's a good chance that they might have a little nibble.
And this information about poisonous plants can be found on the dogstrust.org, can't it?
Yeah, dogstrust.org. And they've got a big list of plants that are poisonous to cats, dogs and horses, I think, as well.
And I'm assuming from the story that that vet had a bit of a familiarisation with what plants could do to a dog, the fact he diagnosed it so quickly. So I'm guessing that some of these vets really are aware of what to do when you bring your dog in like that.
Yeah, and it's probably a kind of almost like a monthly thing. At the right time of year, you know that these plants are in bloom, so they're more likely to be. That's the problem. Whereas later in the year, it's going to be another.
Birds light up our lives all over the world, and Tom Cadwallader's been on an amazing adventure in rainforests and more. Here's Tom's report from, well, a truly exotic-sounding Costa Rica. Check out the background sounds. Amazing.
Well, here I am in Costa Rica. What an exotic place it is. We should have been here in March of 2020, but we all know what happened then. The world locked down. And yes, so this is our postponed trip from 2020. So 3 years later, we've actually made it back. But what an amazing country. And you think, well, why did you pick Costa Rica? Well, I love traveling anyway. And I like the Americas. Costa Rica is in Central America next to Nicaragua and Panama. And I like Central America. I like South America. It's just amazing. It's very, very cosmopolitan. It's just full of wildlife, full of kind of amazing atmospheres and landscapes. It's just tremendous. But yes, Costa Rica is just one of the places in the world to go to. It's rich diversity. It's wildlife diversity. It's absolutely tremendous. Great range of habitats from the kind of coastal areas of the Caribbean, or the Caribbean as they like to call it, to the Pacific coast. Up north, you have a kind of a dry forest areas, you have wet rainforests, you have cloud forests, you have mountains, you have lowlands, yes, and there's quite a significant bit of caldera, which are the kind of remnant volcanoes, but they do tell us that the volcanoes are still active, so you just never know what's around the corner. But it's an amazing place, actually. The weather is incredible, actually. We've travelled through quite a mixture. Heavy, heavy rain, and really, and I mean heavy, heavy rain, have almost been washed out of places, to great dry areas, and sunny and warm, and you get out on the Pacific coast, in the southwest, and you're in the hands of the most humid temperature you can imagine. 100% humidity and temperatures of 38 degrees. Oh, it's incredible. And it's really sapping and it's exhausting at the same time, the whole thing. But it's brilliant. Sunshine, cloud, the works. But yes, why Costa Rica? As I mentioned, it's an area rich in diversity, fantastic habitats. But there's a great sort of range of species to be found here. My big interest is birds, basically, as you'll remember. And this trip has just been amazing. So far, I've seen over 500 species of birds. And I've travelled with a company called Costa Rica Gateway. And the owner of Costa Rica Gateway is a guy called Kevin Easley. And he's North American, but he's lived in Costa Rica for 20 odd years, and he knows all the nooks and crannies. He knows where all the good birds are. We've seen some incredible things. We've seen some resident species which are kind of native to the Central America. We've also seen quite a number of North American species which have wintered in South America and in Central America, which are now, because it's March, it springs on its way, they've headed they're heading north, and we've seen some amazing migrations. The other day we were out and we witnessed an incredible migration of birds of prey. Swainson's hawks, which are related to our common buzzards. Swainson's hawks are really quite broad-winged hawks. They're butios, so they're not really hawks, but they're butios, buzzards. They've wintered in South America, and they've moved through. And in about half an hour, we'd witnessed about 40,000 birds going through on a broad front. And that, I tell you, is something quite amazing. But from that point of view, we've seen a lot of small American waders on the shoreline. We've also seen lots of American warblers. Now, some of these American warblers are just so colourful, you couldn't believe. You know, this great sort of names, chestnut-sided warbler was probably one of the most colourful birds we saw. We've also seen flame-throated warbler, which is a native to Costa Rica. But we've seen some great sort of exotic things. Resplendent quetzal is a fantastic bird, green and red, with the males have got a tail of about 18 inches long. And they fly through the rainforest, and they're incredibly sort of beautiful birds. But we've also seen some dull-coloured birds. Some of our thrushes, related to some of our thrushes are here. The country bird, the Costa Rican bird, is the clay-coloured robin, or now is the clay-coloured thrush. And this is kind of a beige colour with a bit of whiteness on it. And it's about the size of our blackbird. And this is found absolutely everywhere in almost every habitat. So this is the state bird or the country bird of Costa Rica. It's amazing. It's fun to think that they've got all these parrots and all these macaws and all these kind of crazy things to choose from. And they chose the clay-coloured thrush, which is quite interesting. The Costa Ricans, they're so friendly themselves, and you think, and they're quite flamboyant in a way. And you think, why on earth did you pick this? But they did, and that's the way it is. But also, the country is just full of mammals as well. There's some great things. You know, there's frogs, poisonous tree frogs, black and green tree frogs, tiny little creatures, but they make the noise of the rainforest, of the jungle. And there's yellow frogs, little tiny ones as well, all poisonous. And in times gone by, some of the natives have used the poison from some of these frogs to make poison darts to collect food. We've also heard lots and lots of howler monkeys. And these are kind of warlike sort of creatures who make great noises through the forest. And you think, goodness me, what's going on there? But actually, they're harmless to humans. But they create quite a significant backdrop. And hopefully, you can hear some of the noises from the forest just around me, behind me, because I'm recording this whilst I'm there. And two species that will stick in your mind about all these kind of rainforesty areas are the sloths. And there are two species of sloth, and there's a two-toed sloth and a three-toed sloth. And these just look, you see them in the trees, and they're just look like bundles of twigs, you know. They're not much bigger than small dogs, really, but they can climb at very slow motion. And they're great, and they look so unkempt, but they're incredible. They've got sort of almost human-like faces, but they're kind of, but obviously they're not human. But they climb at such a slow pace, and as they climb through trees and the insects, and they've got other wildlife. Now, there's one sloth has a number of moth species associated with it, living symbiotically with it. And it's quite incredible. The other species of mammals we've seen are the coyotes, which are four-legged mammals, and they've got long tails, and they're related to raccoons. So the coyotes are kind of cute things, and they have lived on the learned to live quite close to man. But some of the more kind of spectacular species are the caimans, the alligators, you know, the crocodilia. So these caimans are really quite a long way around the islands. And any of the wet areas will find caimans. But it's been an amazing experience, and one which kind of has become all the more kind of special because of our having to delay it because of the COVID lockdown. And I'm so glad we've got to see these things. Over 500 species of birds. Oh, goodness knows how many species of mammoths. It's been an amazing thing. One of the birds I really wanted to see was the royal flycatcher. Quite an indistinct species, but it's one of my kind of favourites. But actually, the real favourite was the kind of the catalyst who was wanting to come to Costa Rica, and that was the resplendent quetzal. The name is wonderful, and as I mentioned earlier, it is just an amazing bird, green and red underneath, and the males have got these very, very long tails. We saw them in one or two places of rainforests in the highlands, and some of the highlands are up to 14,000 feet, and it's incredible. And it's cold as well, you know, you contrast that with 38 degrees in the lowlands to kind of 2 to 3 degrees on the kind of the mountainous areas of the Talamanca range, just south of San Jose, the capital. But yes, it's been a great treat and a great delight. We'll be home in a couple of days and back to the UK weather and early spring. And I'm looking forward to that because a lot of the spring migrants will be coming in. But what a great sort of experience it's been all told. And I love it. It really is. Great thrill to me. Great stuff. Thanks, folks. Bye.
This is the Nature Garden Podcast.
And so, to the sound of War Blackbird, here's Tom with some things to be getting on with in the spring garden.
It's jobs for the week time. If you haven't mown the lawn, get it mown. If you haven't sown those early vegetable seeds, get them sown. And plant the potatoes, of course. When that's finished, I'm sure you'll find plenty other jobs in the garden. The greenhouse has daily attention from me at the moment. We've been sowing one or two early vegetables and ornamental plants in the garden room conservatory in moderate warmth. They germinated. We've pricked out the seedlings. Some are grown in cell trays, so we just knocked the little cell out gently and potted it into a pot. So many of them are growing in pots in the unheated greenhouse, or cold greenhouse, as I call it, because there's no artificial heat in there. It relies on solar warmth from the sun, of course. They harden off gently in there. Problem is, at the moment, the temperature in the evening has been down to 3, sometimes 4 Celsius, just above freezing, frankly. That's in the evening. It's recorded on the maximum min thermometer, which is very useful to have. For the cost, about £20 or something, it's a daily check, and it's just brilliant. Keeps me in check with the temperature, and that helps the plants, or developing plants, and the existing plants enormously. During the day, it has gone from 3 to 4 Celsius up to over 20 degrees Celsius. That's a horrific range for just 12 hours or so. Amazing. So, during the day, we've got the situation where I have developing plants in the greenhouse, and even the air vents, automatic ventilators in the roof of the greenhouse, the large greenhouse, they aren't coping, keeping the heat down. So, I don't want to put water down on the floor to damp it down and reduce the heat this time of year, because going into the cold at night, a lot of water around is not good for the plants. They could rot off. So, I open the door, open the side vents myself, which are manually operated, to keep the warmth down. This is particularly important if you have things like tomatoes in, young tomato plants, which I have. They've been toughened. The leaves aren't turning blue, which they do if they've had a poor night with their cold temperatures. So it's a balancing act, keeping the warmth down at the height of the day in a greenhouse. I'm closing up about 2 o'clock, 2:30, to build up a head of warmth for the evening to see them through the frosty nights. That's key to me at the moment. What else am I doing? Well, I'm potting up, pricking out, potting on plants as they develop. I'm out in the garden most days. I'm looking around the shrubs. There's good displays at the moment. And particularly from the Forsythia, the yellow Forsythia, still out flowering its socks off, beautiful. The yellow, golden. The ribes, flowering currant, have it in pinks and reds, and that's attractive too. And of course, the bees are enjoying it. So, enjoyment is part of your jobs for the week. Take a little time out now and again. Now, don't be working all of the time. You know, gardening, it's a mental thing, really. Tending it can bring a diversity of mental and physical rewards. But there are occasions when the sense of urgency, oh, I must do the weeding, I must do some more mulching around the fruit trees, which I'm doing at the moment, by the way. I'm bringing lots of well-rotted organic matter from the stables where we keep a horse, and that is spreading beautifully. That retains moisture during the summer, suppresses weeds, and put on in the autumn as well, a second dose in the autumn, it keeps relative warmth in the soil, which the plant benefits from. That's the fruit trees and the bush fruits as well, the black currants, the red currants, and the raspberries. I've just been mulching them this week. They have a lot of surface roots, raspberries, and this helps a great deal. So, take a break from that. Go to the local garden centre, see what plugs they've got in. Plant plugs, vegetable plugs, and ornamental plant plugs as well. And get them potted up when you come home. Head start for you. Get out to see the marvellous displays of daffodils in parkland and in gardens open to the public. And most of all, this within a couple of weeks, I'll be looking to going into the Annick Garden nearby, and they have 329 Taihaku cherry trees in an orchard, the great white cherry, and their canopy is just about meeting, so it's like walking down a tunnel under all of this beautiful white cherry blossom. Brilliant. Whatever you're doing over the coming week, enjoy your gardening.
You've been listening to Gardener Tom Pattinson and Birder Tom Cadwallander from the British Trust for Ornithology, and John Knox and Dean Smith from the Annick Poison Garden. I'm Carl Steinson, and, well, don't forget you can listen to us every month on Lionheart Radio. That's www.lionheartradio.com. And you can catch up with all the previous episodes, of course, of the Nature Garden podcast on your very favourite listening device or station or outlet. It's great to be back, and welcome if you're a first-time listener. Enjoy your gardening and time outdoors with nature. Bye for now.